The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Bank, Africa's largest agri-funder. The bravery to imagine, that's African nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Good to have you with us. Good news that chicken prices should come down fairly soon, but it's going to come at a cost, of course, to the domestic industry. How much does that concern you, I wonder? Also, what do you make of today's big announcements? Five government ministers in a row, not all in agreement, not all on the same page in terms of the future of energy provision. I wonder what your view is on the outlook for electricity. There was something of a breakthrough today on the electricity crisis. We saw the industry minister, Ibrahim Patel, saying local content requirements for solar projects will be temporarily relaxed until the country solves its electricity crisis. That may take a while. For example, look at bid window 5, for example. You've needed to have 100% local content, and we simply don't have capacity. Bidders now only have to get 35% of their solar cells from local suppliers. So hopefully that gives the local suppliers time to focus on the quality and to gear up, because there's going to be no end in demand there. The Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan saying intervention of getting additional power online could take between 12 to 36 months to achieve. So this is not an overnight solution. The Energy Minister today admitting that government, of course, left this crisis to fester. Gwede Mantashe saying in 1998, government was told that it would need new capacity by 2007 and did squat in order to provide that. And the state has always known there was a crisis. Then, of course, in 2007, we ran out of electricity. And ever since then, we've had intermittent bouts of load shedding, some considerably worse than others, despite adding new capacity to the grid that doesn't work properly. The Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, of course, re-emphasizing that Eskom's debt is unsustainable and therefore it places a risk to the sovereign. So to avoid sovereign risk, government has to step in. That principle is agreed to. There's going to be a cabinet lehotla on the 1st of September to deal with the issue and decide just how much of that power is going to be taken onto the Eskom grid. And then we've heard this story before, but Pravin Gordhan saying that a team of former Eskom managers will assist at power stations, which is good, and a training program. This will drive you mad, at least it should. A training program will be reinstituted at Eskom. Goodness knows why it stopped. It lasts between 20 to 24 months, and then it's to get leadership to run power stations. First 20 candidates have entered the program. But I mean, just the shambles at Eskom over a decade or more of mismanagement by varying degrees by a host of people has led to a catastrophic outcome for you and me. Anyway, that's the power solution that's going to come our way in the not too distant future. One of the consequences, of course, of persistent power outages is a lack of economic confidence, a lack of confidence in the future. And it's being revealed and exposed by the Purchasing Managers Index, which comes through from APSA regularly. It's the APSA PMI, the research done by the Bureau for Economic Research. Economist there is Lizette Isor-Deschep. And Lizette, welcome to The Money Show this evening. Just give me a perspective, please, on this APSA PMI number, which has come in below 50 once again. Is it pointing towards recessionary conditions building, or is it purely to do with the power situation?
Well, it's a good evening first. It's unfortunate that it's the fourth month or so that the manufacturing sector is showing a sign of slowing. We know that the second quarter was quite weak for the sector, with specific factors. We had the KZN flooding, we had other issues. So we were hoping sort of a rebound in the third quarter, and the PMI is suggesting that that isn't happening. As you said, the headline PMI index fell below 50, technically signaling a contraction. And this is the first time since July 2021 when we saw the looting and unrest in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng that hurt output. So I think this time around, we can lay the blame at the electricity supply disruptions. We had load shedding, but also a lot of the respondents mentioned cable theft as a big issue of output losses.
So what does this mean then in terms of the performance of the economy? Is this a short-term anomaly? Do we go back to sort of bumbling along at 2%? Or are we at risk of following other big global economies into negative territory once again?
Yeah, I think the global story is part of what's happening with the local manufacturing sector as well. If you look on the export side of the PMI index, that also showed quite a significant dip. If we look at the global manufacturing PMI, that one declined once again, still above 50, but the lowest level in about 2 years. And for South Africa, it's very difficult to do very well in an environment, a global environment that is struggling. And on top of that, we have the load shedding and general electricity supply disruptions. So that is negatively affecting the sector. And if you look at what respondents expect about conditions going forward, they certainly don't see this as a temporary blip. If you look at the expectations index, that actually fell below 50 now too. And that's the first time since the second quarter of 2020. And that was when we were in the strictest phase of our COVID-19 lockdown. That was the last time that respondents actually thought conditions were going to get worse than they are now. And we're back there once again. Now, hopefully they're wrong, and hopefully we do see a bit of a pickup in the domestic economy that generates some momentum. But it is quite concerning to see the majority of respondents being so worried.
Thank you, Lizette Esel at Skepper this evening. Lizette is an economist at the Bureau for Economic Research at Stellenbosch.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, the cost of food particularly going up, and it's hurting absolutely everyone, not only here but around the world. Hopes that the resumption of grain exports out of Ukraine will help alleviate some pressure, as Ukraine is responsible for something like 15% of all grains consumed around the world. In its response to the cost of living crisis in South Africa, the government here suspending dumping duties on chicken imported from Brazil, from Spain, from Portugal, Ireland, and Denmark, saying that it will reconsider in 12 months what to do. It's a major win for you as a consumer. It's a big blow, however, for domestic chicken producers. Paul Matthews is chief executive at the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters. Did you expect to get this one over the line, Paul?
Yeah, evening, Bruce. Yes, we definitely live in an interesting time. As you're aware, you know, we had been lobbying with government for a moratorium of about 3 years, but we're very happy with the 12 months. And definitely, it's a great win for the SA consumer. Yeah, very interesting, you know, that Minister Patel took the decision.
It's a win for the consumer now, for at least the next 12 months, as we get to have a choice of chicken products and chicken supplies, and possibly see a reduction in pricing. I mean, that's ultimately the goal, isn't it? But 12 months from now, will we have fewer chicken producers in South Africa, which will then make imports that much, make us even more dependent on imports than before?
No, definitely not, Bruce. You know, I think we got to look at the numbers. If you have a look at the imports on bone-in chicken with the local producers are always screaming about being a problem from the import side, the trade is so down. You know, from the March 2021 62% tariff, I mean, we're already 37% down on trade. And just from January to the end of June, compared to last year, we're already 37% down. So I don't really see a huge impact for them. I think we also got to take in consideration here that obviously the minister has...
Sorry, Paul, we've lost you there. Obviously, the minister had... No, we lost you there, Paul, sorry. You said, obviously, the minister had, and it was not obvious because we didn't hear what you had to say. So the minister has done what?
I said, obviously, the minister has used his announcement today to the food prices and helping the consumer. But I think we need to take into consideration as well that, you know, this whole investigation has taken place over the last year. We've been fighting with Artec, saying that we didn't believe there was a material injury to local producers. We did not believe there was dumping. Understanding that Spain, Poland, Ireland, Denmark have been closed because of AR. So we've been fighting that as well. So I think one's got to look into this. Obviously, we're going to have to see what the Artec report looks like. We don't know what those proposed dumping percentages look like and what he has put on hold for the next 12 months. But I think we need to also look into this to say, has there really been dumping here?
Okay. But Paul, let's cut to the chase. How much can we expect chicken prices to drop by as a result of the fact that these duties now have been lifted for the next 12 months? Can we expect a 10, 20, 30, 40, pick a number, percent reduction in the cost of chicken? Because if that doesn't happen, and then it happens at a cost to the domestic industry, which then makes it harder for us to be globally competitive into the future, that would have been a bit of a waste of time. What are you expecting to happen to prices?
It's a hard one to answer because obviously you gain to the local producers have already said today that prices are going up because of lack of electricity, water, what's happening in Ukraine and Russia. So one hopes for at least a 6% reduction. I think that's what we really hope for. But it's going to be up to the local producers now to come to the party. The fact that they don't have a tariff now to compare against and to up their prices, let's see what they do. But if we can get a 6%, I think we're doing well for the consumer.
Thank you, Paul Matthews, Chief Executive at the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters. Is that a price worth paying, potentially at the expense of the local industry? Or is the local industry sufficiently profitable that we don't need to worry about it one little bit, and every percentage point reduction we can get in chicken prices? I'm quite cynical about this. I don't anticipate that the price of chicken will come down at all. I think we'll find ways to keep prices elevated. I'm not 100% convinced that this is the answer to the problem, but let's see. Let's benchmark the price of chicken, look at it a month, 2 months, 6 months from now, and see if it had a positive impact.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
You may want to talk chicken. You may want to talk electricity. You may want to talk the weekend ANC policy conference. 011-883-0702. You can tweet us at Bruce Business or send a WhatsApp to 072-702-1702. Let's get a quick lickety-split look at the ANC policy conference over the weekend. Recycling populist ideas instead of dealing with the fundamental issue, which is the fact that there is no growth and no opportunity for people to uplift themselves. So one of the big resolutions taken over the weekend was to reconsider a wealth tax. It's one of these perennial favorites that gets dusted off and thrown onto the policy agenda. That and nationalizing the Reserve Bank. And no new ideas. I saw a piece in the Financial Mail just a moment ago saying, Sam Kuleli saying this evening that the ANC policy conference shows how ordinary the party of Nelson Mandela has become. Teto Matlokwana is with the Eyewitness News team. Was it a very ordinary conference other than the big issues of step aside and the hype cycle around that, Teto?
Good evening, Bruce. And I think Sam's description of the party as ordinary was really generous. It was below par if a comparison to past gatherings was to be made, more so in light of the crises, multiple crises that society faces. One would have thought that if there's an issue that must get delegates to rally behind would be the fact that South Africans are crying from all sides, saying we need some sort of a solution to not only the mass unemployment crisis, but to the continued spiraling cost of daily basic products. But you come out of that conference with the sense that the ANC does not understand how macroeconomic policy works, nor are they interested in learning how it works from those among them, like, you know, Godongwana, who, of course, would take a different stance on issues that are just polished or PR'd over instead of being ventilated in a realistic manner. A resolution, for example, that comes out, or even a discussion that they say they need to ventilate further around how mass unemployment should be declared a national crisis. It's just one of the examples that you look at to understand that the idea around what is needed to solve the crisis is not quite thoroughly thought of. And when you ask, I asked Mamaluka Kubaya, who is the Economic Transformation Committee Chairperson, in one of their briefings, but what does it do? You know, what can you unlock in the economy when you say mass unemployment is now a national crisis? And she makes an example of how South Africans rally together to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. And she says maybe we can look at some of the solutions that were tapped into for that crisis. And you and I, Bruce, know that the unemployment insurance fund cannot keep being over, you know, extended to supply the country with the kind of money needed for those programs. So
and you can't tax yourself into prosperity, Teto. I mean, the, most of the real money has been squirreled away, and you might get away with it once, and then fine. So you get a bit of a boon, and you can make it last 1 or 2 years, and you can pay out your basic income grant, and that'd be lovely. But unless you've got a strategy for growth, then you've wasted the entire weekend, hundreds of hours of airtime, and we go back to the drawing board, and no progress really was made at this conference, Teto. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with you, and it's just so discouraging to have to reflect on this very fact. And even the debate around the basic income grant, you cannot go back to an old idea that you tried to push through but did not work, but not only because it did not receive the support you hoped it would receive from the market, but the wealth tax idea, Bruce, the idea that you want to go that route must be supported by some sort of evidence that says the tax base is actually enough to even go that route. But we know how narrow it is. Even if you were to tap into it, how long can you sustain a universal basic income grant that is going to cover over 12 million people who are unemployed but willing to be employed? And you don't want to talk about the levers in the economy that you can unlock to ensure that people access job opportunities. Yet you still want to do this merry-go-round and talk about, you know, let's get capital to give back, to build this developmental state. You talk about how we must ensure that the National Democratic Revolution is realized. I spoke to Enoch Odongwana on the sidelines of the conference. He's the finance minister, Bruce, and he's also, of course, the former chairperson of that transformation, economic transformation committee. And he was stuck, I think, between a hard place and a rock, because he doesn't want to overstep on Mamoruko Kubaya's new role. But at the same time, he needs to bring the sensibility that's needed from a government perspective to say, but, you know, some of these things that cannot be realized. He says to me, we don't know what form or shape the BIG may take if it's ever realized. But what we do know is that we need to have some sort of a grant system in place. And I say to him, you know, the United Nations Development Program released a study 3 weeks ago saying that, in fact, this short-term grant, you know, special grant release are really effective. They're effective. They've learned the lessons from the COVID-19 pandemic from a lot of developing economies.
Teto, we must leave it there. Yes, they're effective. Yes, they're important. Yes, we must have capacity to do it, but you don't do it the way in which the ANC is proposing it. It's and the finance minister has been through this. He's watched this movie. This is like a rerun of the worst movie he's watched. It's like going to, you know, to like old Saturday night movies. They were just rubbish, B-grade movies. Enoch Odongwana has been through the process. He's paid lip service to the process. They've interrogated it. Now we go back to square one again. What a waste of time. Charles De Wet is the head of tax at ENS. You don't want to raise another issue on chicken and chicken pricing. Government wants to ensure that we scrap the anti-dumping tariffs on chicken, which the importers say could reduce the price by about 6%, Charles. What else do you want to add into the mix there?
Well, Bruce, I mean, what was on the agenda last time the VAT rate went up? And I see we're talking about more VAT increases to fund other important programs. But there's still no meat that is zero rated for VAT purposes. And, you know, chicken would have been a good one. And while there was, you know, all these structural changes happening in the industry, the VAT-free chicken should have been on the agenda as well.
Thank you, Charles De Wet, head of tax at ENS. That would save another 15%.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
So Merrill Pick on what has been a bit of a languid day for markets, Merrill Pick. A little bit up in the US, a little bit down across Europe, and a little bit more down on the JSE. But one standout is a company called Quilter. Quilter was the bit left behind in the United Kingdom by Old Mutual. Merrill Peck is a portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. What do you think's going on with Quilter? I didn't see any announcements or any news flow around Quilter today. What have you seen, Merrill?
Yes, good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. On a very flat day, Quilter closed just over 15% up. And you're right, you won't spot Sen's announcement regarding that. But there was some news flow, rumors rather, and media publications quoting a potential offer being made by a bank, retail bank in the UK called NatWest, for Quilter. So basically potential M&A. And I think that speculation around M&A is driving the price up today. Quilter is a UK asset management business. It's integrated. It's got in-house fund management as well as an advisory team, and also a investment platform which external independent advisors can use. So this is the kind of business that has been, or kind of stock that has been under pressure as markets are selling off, recession risk rising, or actually now playing out. So the stock's been under immense pressure over the last few months, and I think today this news that someone's interested in buying it, I suppose, clearly then there's value. That's a sign that there's value underlying. And longer term, the market that they play in, being the UK investment space, structurally has got a lot of growth or quite strong growth driver. Unlike South Africa, where there's quite tight regulation, particularly around pension with Regulation 28, that market was, regulation was eased a few years ago. So investors retiring especially have a lot of options with what to do with their wealth. And that level of autonomy is great, but actually most people need a lot of advice to know what to do, and how to invest wisely. So that structural change a few years ago actually left individual retail investors with a lot more choice, and therefore structurally driving up a strong positive theme for being the need for more advice, investment advice.
This is potentially
a beneficiary of that trend.
This is potentially a benefit for Old Mutual, which remains a shareholder, I think, in Quilter. It's no longer the controlling shareholder, but it is invested there. And it's also interesting from a UK bank's recovery perspective that a NatWest is on the market buying things, because 2008, of course, the wheels fell off and nobody could buy anything.
So I think, yes, on the one hand, it's indicative of structurally what's changed in banks, in that balance sheets are generally better in most markets versus 2008, and banks are inherently less risky because of Basel 1, 2, 3. But also, I think it shows perhaps the banks looking for growth outside of traditional banking. And a lot of their traditional services coming under disruptive threat from payments apps and payment services and fintech. So banks are then seeing disruption and pressure on their own fees for their traditional businesses. And I think we're starting to see banks, or there's been a theme for quite a while of banks bleeding into other financial services territory, so either insurance or wealth management, and being able to give an integrated offer to clients.
Meryl Pick, thank you. Portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group on what was really, by global standards, quite a flat day. Thank you, Meryl.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, Africa's largest agri-funder. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
I mean, even though I'm quite grumpy about the ANC policy conference and the amount of time that is wasted regurgitating failed ideas and ideas that are never going to cut the mustard, I do think we're making a huge amount of progress, slow, steady progress, one step forward, sometimes two steps back, sometimes more, but generally making slow, agonizingly slow progress, not fast enough by any stretch of the imagination. If you want to talk about that, if you want to pick up on a really good news story coming up in a moment, and that is all about the fact that there's been a big breakthrough in car exports out of the Eastern Cape, we can pick up on that too if you like. 011-883-0702. You can also tweet us on @BruceBusiness or a WhatsApp to 072-702-1702. On the next Money Show, Distell and JSE executives taking us through financial results. We'll have a tipple on that. Plus, Maya Fisher-French, a financial consumer journalist, is our head teacher on our investment school, explaining how to get passive income from shares and why property is not a passive investment. We'll analyze all the other big money stories on the day next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, Port Elizabeth Car Terminal, should be called the Gqeberha Car Terminal, but the Transnet will get the new boards up soon, I'm sure. The Port Elizabeth Car Terminal has broken its own record, handling 24,142 fully built units in July. It's the highest ever at the terminal and 93% above the planned monthly budget. Let's talk this evening to Wandisa Vazi. Wandisa is managing executive at the Eastern Cape Terminals. Wandisa, are these all VWs or are these other manufacturers who are now also utilizing that port facility to export their vehicles that they build in South Africa?
Good evening, Bruce. It's not only VW units that we are seeing that hit the record this month, although also VW hit its own record at the beginning of July, where we were loading 5,300 units in one vessel on its own. The biggest vessel that we've loaded for VW was 4,500 units. But what we've seen as well is the transshipment volumes from Suzuki, Tata and Caterpillar that have started calling in the Gqeberha terminal, auto terminal.
So the handling is importing. The handling is imports and exports. So imports of Suzuki, imports of Tata, Caterpillar, and some Volkswagen. And of course, then Volkswagen is the primary producer at Uitenhage, therefore exports there. And there was also talk of Ford also ramping up its capacity in the Eastern Cape. Have we seen an uptick in Ford exports as well?
We definitely have seen a boost. An uptake in Ford as well. We've started handling Ford volumes on a monthly basis now. So Ford has started calling the Gqeberha auto terminal as well. And we're seeing also other OEMs, as I alluded earlier on, the Suzuki, the Tatas, that have also started calling the Gqeberha auto terminal. So it's been a great, great increase of the volumes that we're seeing and the business picking up in the Gqeberha auto terminal.
And I see you calling it the Gqeberha Auto Terminal. That's on the press release, it's called the Port Elizabeth Car Terminal, but that's probably just habit. And when we're talking about the Gqeberha Auto Terminal, this is at the Ngqura Port, isn't it? This is as you drive out of Gqeberha on the N2 towards East London and towards Transkei. It's that big development on the right-hand side where there's a Cerebos salt plant and there is a whole bunch of factories, and in there is the port. Now, what does it take to manage 24,142 vehicles in and out of that port? Are you operating on an 18-hour day, 24-hour day? What's it take?
In fact, Bruce, it's in the old PE port terminal. It's not even in the Ngqura terminal, because in the Ngqura we only handle containers. This one is your auto roll-on, roll-off terminal that we have in the PE right in the city center.
That old place with all of that difficult access and everything else. My goodness gracious me, I've learned something. Thank you.
So, yes, that's where we're handling it. And the auto terminal is there in the old PE terminal.
My goodness gracious me. How many hours a day are you operating? I mean, how are you getting that sort of volume in? You've got record levels of volume. Is it simply more efficient work or is it many, many longer hours?
Okay. We operate 24 hours in all our terminals. But what we have seen and what we've been focusing on is definitely to improve our efficiencies. We have improved also our operational efficiencies by 11% since April. So we've seen the units per hour that we load on a vessel. We used to load about 180 units in an hour. Now we are averaging around 205, 210 units per hour. So we've also seen a great improvement in our efficiencies, and that is all in collaboration with our customers.
Brilliant. Thank you, Wandi Savazi, Managing Executive at the Eastern Cape Terminals in Gqeberha this evening. That old port, as you fly in, as your plane is wiggling from left to right and dropping 50 metres and going up 100 metres. You know, it's quite bumpy as you come into the airport, the Chief David Stegerman Airport. It's there, down there on the right-hand side. It's busy. It's great.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Is it a breakthrough today in the energy industry with the Minister Abraham Patel, who's in charge of trade, industry and competition, saying that he will suspend briefly requirements for solar projects, going to relax those requirements for 100% local content down to 35. Let us talk to Professor Samson Mapueli, who is a director at the Center for Renewable Energy at Stellenbosch University. Prof, good evening to you. Big breakthrough today. Is this what the industry has been waiting for?
Good evening to you and the listeners. They welcome most of the interventions from the interventions that the president announced to the interventions that the various ministers announced today, which is basically going a little bit deeper into what the president has said, even though most of them just repeated what the president has said, but we welcome those announcements. The issue of local content, for me, we need to have a time frame on it. Otherwise, we will have a lot of, for lack of a better word, dumping of technologies into South Africa. The space has been opened up, so we're going to see a lot more growth in renewable energy technologies uptake. I welcome the announcement that the local content will go down to 30%. We can still need that local content, and I understand because we don't have the manufacturing capacity or the assembly capacity that we envisage that will be needed when the space opens up the way the president has opened it up. We only have two manufacturing, or basically those are assembly plants. They are not even manufacturing plants because they are importing the wafers from China and then just assembling them in the country. We would like to see more of those coming up. So we need a kind of a timeline to say these local content will be ramped up as time goes by. Like, for instance, in the next 2 years, we need to increase the local content requirements to about 50%, and then we can increase as we go.
It's about encouraging local investment, but people can't be investing and building at the same time and creating the factories and building these solar panels. So does this then shorten the dreaded time of load shedding? Does it actually make a whole lot of difference, Prof, in terms of our ability to get out of load shedding, hopefully for good in the not too distant future?
So the measures that have been introduced are short-term, mid-term, and long-term measures. The things such as the procurement of new generation capacity, bid window 7 being brought forward and then being included in bid window 6, that is a long-term measure because we're looking at about 3 years from now before you can get any power from that kind of a program coming online. But there are other measures such as the energy efficiency measures that can have immediate impact. There are measures around the procurement of about 200 megawatts from the power pool that I've been telling people from the time that the president made the announcement that we won't get that much. We'll get about 200 megawatts from the power pool, which we were getting anyway, because South Africa is the major player in the Southern African power pool. We are the ones who give more electricity than we get. But that will have an immediate impact because 200 megawatts, we can use that to supply our pumped storage during the day and when the system is constrained and things like that. New generation capacity coming in from bid window 5, about 800 megawatts or so, that will assist us a lot. The small scale and budget generation, we still need to finalize the regulations. The regulations around environmental assessment those are also meant for long term, because from the time that those are promulgated and accepted by all parties, we will then start to have projects being developed at that particular time. And developing and building a big power station, a renewable energy power station, takes about 2 years. The good thing about it, though, is that renewable energy plants can be built within time and within budget without a lot of cost escalations.
Professor Samson Mabweri, thank you very much indeed. Director at the Center for Renewable Energy at Stellenbosch University. Somebody who is not buying the hype of the fixes to the power crisis, and that is our own Toby Shapshak. He's the chief at Stuff Studios. Tech with Toby in a moment. The energy plan, yes, it's lovely, but how good are we at implementing plans? How good are we at getting all of these plans off the ground? Well, probably not that good if history is our guide. How do you protect yourself against the lag of implementation of the plans when it comes to the energy solution? In a bit with Toby Shapshak.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
The president has come up with a 10-point energy plan. Five of his government ministers today were talking about how they were going to do their bit to make it all happen. Toby Shapshak, I don't think you're that confident in the ability of government to deliver solutions to energy. So what alternatives do you propose?
Bruce, are you alleging that government is all talk and no action? I couldn't believe that.
Sometimes there's not even talk.
No even talk, yes. So my wife and I last year went solar, and it's a complex problem, but I thought I'd just break it down in as simple a way as possible. There's a way to do the full Monty, as it were. You put up solar panels, you get an inverter, and you get batteries, you re-rig your whole house, or you can just do it in component parts, obviously depending on how much you want to spend. If people want to know, the easiest and quickest way is to just put in some batteries and an inverter. People often say, I've got an inverter, but actually what they mean is I've got an inverter and batteries, because the inverter is the brains of the operation. The inverter is the Bruce Whitfield of a renewable renewable system. The batteries are what store the power, and actually you can feed that from anything. You can feed it from the grid, you can feed it from solar, you could feed it from gas turbines, you know, you could even believe Gwede Mantashe and car power ships might actually be useful and not a waste of money. So the essential simplest system that you could probably put in is a 2.4 kilowatt system with an inverter that's about 1,000 watts, and that'll cost you about 15,000 rand. It'll run a TV, a hi-fi laptop, PC, some lights. What you need to do is change all your light bulbs to LEDs. They're much more energy efficient. They don't use as much energy as an incandescent light bulb or those old funny neon CVCs. And that's one of the simplest ways. And then just be a little bit savvy about it. Don't run your irrigation. Don't run aircon. You can't run your geyser. Don't run your pool pump. A kettle is a very big consumer of power, whereas a fridge actually isn't. Once a fridge is cold or a freezer is cold, just leave the door closed. So 15,000 rand will get you this 2.4 kilowatt system. A 5,000 kilowatt system would cost you about 50,000, and that's kind of what the average house would use. But then also do savvy things. You know, if you don't have a gas hob in your house, put in a gas hob. Or I went on to Every Shop Now while I was waiting and listening to the prof. You can buy an Elva single burner canister stove. The power thing looks like a kind of can of cockroach spray, and I'm not talking about like insect spray, and that costs about $430. So you can use that to make a cup of tea, heat up your food, that kind of thing. Just be kind of savvy with it. So a lot of people say we can't afford the solar panels. Well, you can buy things in components. You know, Nedbank's got a very good offering that lets you upgrade or pay in advance, pay it off by installation, so that you pay as you go to build up the system. For my mother, for instance, she's 94. Hi, Mark. I have just an inverter and a big battery. So that powers off the grid, but it'll give her 4 hours of battery life. It gives her a DStv. It gives her a TV. Samsung's newer models are very energy efficient. And she will get through load shedding. And I bought her one of those little gas camping stoves so that she can, you know, make dinner and have something to eat. The guy that I get advice from is a guy called Chris Liebenberg. He's just the kind of guru that I go to. He's the Bruce Whitfield.
Okay, now stop that nonsense. The point is, we kind of wish away the problem. We've had electricity unbroken for a whole week. The trouble is that this is a very vulnerable system. It remains vulnerable. It doesn't take much. Every evening, Eskom sends us a message to say, please switch off everything that you don't need, including your lights and your life. And then at 9 o'clock, they come back and say, phew, thank you, we survived another day. It doesn't bode well for the next 2 or 3 years. Government has said it's going to take at least 2 or 3 years. You and I know it's going to take a lot longer than that. It's worth investing if you want to stay connected to the world. I think that's the point that you're making this evening, Toby, in 12 seconds.
It is indeed. Yes, it is. I agree with everything you said. You summed me up nicely. Thank you. I feel almost like the Bruce Whitfield of technology journalists.
Oh, my goodness gracious me. Achievement Stuff Studios. Toby Shapshak. Thank you very much, Toby Shapshak. He joins us with Tech with Toby every Monday evening with platitudes and adoration thrown in for free.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Bank. That's Africa's largest agri-funder. The bravery to imagine that's African nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show on this Monday evening. And in the next hour, Luke Cunnemeyer, who's the Chief Operating Officer at Sweep South, is going to be taking us through a bit of research that they've been doing into the state of the world of domestic work. Sweep South was conceptualized by a team and Alan Ribic and Aisha Pandor got together, and they kind of had been to the United States on holiday and had watched it was Lyft, I think, which was a ride-hailing platform that's a bit like Uber is. They said, hold on a second, can we not use this principle when it comes to domestic work? And they've changed the face of domestic work. And then they've opened up in Kenya, they've opened up in Nigeria, and then last year bought a business called Fik Khaldima in Egypt, and they're integrating that into their systems. But the research, and it's the fifth annual report on pay and working conditions for domestic workers in Africa, and they don't have enough data from Nigeria and Egypt at this stage, but certainly getting a picture for Kenya, getting a very clear picture on South Africa. So pick up on that this evening here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Luke Cunnemeyer is the Chief Operating Officer at Sweep South. Luke, just give me a perspective, please, on this research, how long it's been going, and the sort of data sets you've been able to build over the last 5 years.
Thanks, Bruce, and thanks to your listeners. So our report has been going for 5 years now, so this is our fifth annual report. And while it grew out of a rather small attempt just to try and get benchmarks and a few measures for, you know, was Sweep South as a company reinforcing the current conditions of domestic workers? Did we, as we had set out to initially, were we improving these? And how could we be part of the conversation in terms of trying to improve pay and working conditions for domestic workers? And so while this was initially expected to be an attempt to iterate each year and see how could we better inform the ways we drive improvement, COVID has other ideas. And so we were able to see the measurable impact that was able to have on domestic workers during that time. And sadly, we're still able to show, and I mean, as many expected, that there would still be a continued impact. But obviously, spiraling inflation and other factors have now conspired to make life even more difficult in terms of a recovery post-COVID.
What is happening in terms of jobs numbers, in terms of domestic workers who are employed? Because for many people, it is the difference between life and death in terms of for them personally, and for many, an extended family as well.
So job numbers I don't know quite a term to describe this that's not going to be emotive, but I think bloodbath, honestly, just sums this up in probably the clearest fashion, is that we've seen a massive downturn, a drop from the Q4 2021 to Q1 2022 of around 25% of domestic workers losing their jobs. So that's around, those are female domestic workers. And for us, we also engage with male domestic workers. And there, the workforce in South Africa was halved from around 50,000 individuals to 25,000 male domestic workers still employed. And so that's just like sums up the dire impact. But then the other thing to bear in mind is that then the other factors around inflation spiraling, transport costs and correlated factors then with the increase in petrol price has probably meant that when we see the data coming out of the next quarter, that that factors are actually likely to have worsened in terms of employment. And that's the sort of data that we're seeing predicted by a report, the data that we've been able to surface thus far.
So, I mean, if 25% of domestic workers are losing their jobs, are they moving onto platforms such as yours to at least get some sort of income? I may have been a full-time domestic worker working 40, 50 hours a week up until now, but maybe I'm getting a bit of a hustle going using a Sweep South.
So we've definitely seen a pickup in the number of applications that we're getting as a platform, but the part of what we see is our sort of... what we owe our current base is that we're able to manage utilization levels such that people are earning a decent income. So we don't have a policy that we allow absolutely anyone who applies, even though many of them are competent and are quality workers who definitely would be a very good fit for the platform. We do try and control supply and demand in that way. So we've definitely seen increasing desperation, increasing numbers looking for work and looking to platforms such as ourselves to try and see upliftment in their own incomes accordingly.
Now, if so many people are losing their jobs, what is happening to wage rates? There are regulated wages. The minimum wage in South Africa is a pitiful amount of money. One hopes that the people who can afford to have somebody work in their home are paying substantially beyond the minimum wage. But what is it doing to take home pay? Because suddenly there are lots of people in the market who can do the job. The rules of supply and demand says the cost on average should fall.
So I think this is what we see around the dynamics around domestic work. And where we have to point out this caveat in terms of our data is that when you're looking at domestic worker wages and conditions, you're measuring the domestic workers who still have employment. And those workers who have lost their jobs are often the most vulnerable, those earning lower incomes, because what we see is that those employed by wealthier individuals who do generally pay their workers a bit better, that they have more robust employment. And so we've actually seen that rates are fairly stable within the market, improving beyond the 2019 levels that we saw prior to the COVID pandemic hitting. But while we've seen minimum wage rise year on year, wages have not tracked with us in South Africa. And this is where I am particularly worried, is entering markets like Kenya, where we see minimum wage as largely lip service and an aspirational item. I generally be quite proud that South Africa adheres to minimum wage and that what we should aspire to is a living wage. And this has sadly been reversed now, where we're seeing minimum wages generally keep up and improve for domestic workers, but adherence is shocking and absolutely poor in the market.
No data out of West Africa, no data out of East Africa. I'd say some data out of East Africa, I beg your pardon. No data out of West Africa, and nothing yet out of Fig Khaldima in Egypt.
So what we're seeing in West Africa is that we wanted to go a bit deeper into the data because we weren't quite seeing robust enough data and analysis to really draw conclusions, and we don't want to misguide anyone on the conditions within the markets. But Nigeria is a bit different in that they don't actually have a prescribed minimum wage for domestic workers, and there's actually this challenge one has in markets like Egypt and Nigeria, where domestic work is not even necessarily seen as work. It's not seen as legitimate employment. So one isn't able to really peg them, are people earning minimum wage? It's that, like, are they earning
a decent wage at all? Are they being treated with dignity? Are they being recognized in a particular fashion? So we definitely are looking that as we're able to gather more data in these markets to provide a better depiction so that we have a comprehensive coverage of the north, south, east, and west of Africa.
Thank you to Luke Cunningham. Luke is a Chief Operating Officer at Sweep South, joining us this evening on The Money Show. It makes for really interesting reading and some quite depressing reading as well, and some very important reading as well. Both Kenya and South Africa finding themselves in a precarious position as emerging economies. Resulting economic fallout has had a devastating effect, says the report, on the livelihoods of many workers, disproportionately impacting women, Black Africans and people in poverty at the base of the economic pyramid. Domestic workers often seen as poorly paid with few social protections will be amongst the worst affected due to their reliance on the income of their employer and given their frequent exploitation. Some very, very thought-provoking and moving observations, of course, coming through in this report. It's quick to read. It's easy to read. It's a sobering read. And it gives you a very clear sense of the state of play of many people who live on very, very little in our country.
The Money Show.
Business books.
Get to our business books in just a moment, of course, and that is with Ian Mann. Ian Mann is our regular business book reviewer. Ian Mann is the MD of Gateways Business Consultants. And the book this evening is, as always, a very interesting book. It's called Framers, Human Advantage in the Age of Technology and Turmoil by Kenneth Cook here. Now, I think we got through the phase of panicking all about the issues of AI and computers taking over and doing all the jobs, perhaps, but certainly the role of humans and the role of human advantage in the age of technology is something we've not explored before. So regular book reviewer, Managing Director of Gateways Business Consultants, Ian Mann, what do you like about Kenneth Cookier's book?
Well, firstly, it's something which is an interesting idea that we haven't been thinking about, or haven't been using practically. And that's this idea that human beings always think in terms of systems and in terms of frames, in terms of models. And if we can play around with this, we can understand the world quite differently. I'd like to just give you some concrete examples of what I'm talking about. If you look at, imagine a capitalist and a communist looking at exactly the same thing. The capitalist is looking at forest lands. And he looks at this and he says, there's commercial opportunity here everywhere. The communist looks at this and he reduces it down to class struggle. If he was an industrialist, he'd look at that and say, well, the rainforests, there's masses of timber. It's very valuable today. Environmentalists will look at exactly the same thing and say, this is the lungs of the planet. It's vital for long-term survival. And we essentially seeing exactly the same thing, but because you started with a different frame, you see things very, very differently. And I think that what's happened is that all he's really done is raised awareness of how much our framing matters to what we think. And then goes on to give you some ways of doing it. But just let me give you one example where I think it looks very nice. If you probably remember a guy called Colin Kaepernick, who took the knee at a San Francisco football game.
Absolutely, and yes.
This was during the national anthem. And some people were absolutely outraged about this. He took the knee instead to call attention to racism and police violence. He didn't swear, he didn't scream, he didn't cause trouble. He respectfully and quietly and symbolically protested. Then the people on the other side said this was an appalling act of insolence. Exactly the same thing, two people looking at it differently and seeing something completely different. I think that's where your own awareness of the power of frames is terribly important. And that's what this book is all about.
Okay, so how do we use it in terms of understanding the world in which we live, the age of technology in which we live, and the benefits that our being human, because the only thing that's different between us and computers is that we are human. And that should be a huge advantage. How do we make it work for us?
Let's take something very, very concrete. Look at two countries who've experienced COVID. How you frame this virus will determine a lot of things. And initially in 2002, it wasn't clear what sort of disease the world was dealing with. We'd had 7 coronaviruses already, and some caused common colds, and others like SARS and MERS proved to be very, very harsh. The idea of longer incubation periods in some places causes fatalities, some places it doesn't. But the way countries responded to this was very interesting. If you look at New Zealand, New Zealand framed COVID as if it was like SARS. And because of that, they had an elimination approach. Britain framed COVID as being more like seasonal flu, and they had a different strategy. The Prime Minister of New Zealand declared her country COVID-free. Britain recorded 50,000 COVID-related fatalities, the highest in the world. Two countries, same data, same goals, but different frames, and they came up with different results. And I think it's practical as all that. We have to worry very, very much about this, because doing it wrong, choosing the wrong frames and misframing things can cause enormous catastrophe, or can give enormous advantage. And I think that's where the interesting part of this book comes in. But just give you one example. During the Soviet era in the 30s, there was a theory of plant genetics which was based on Marxist-Leninist ideology, not botany. And the man who was promoting this, a guy called Lysenko, and he had the support of Stalin. And therefore, his theory couldn't be questioned. Scientists that were questioned, they questioned it, either fired, imprisoned, exiled, or executed. The result of this was, the theory held, that crops can be planted very, very closely together. And the reason for that was because communist theory says members of the same class living in solidarity don't compete against each other for resources. What happens, they over-cultivated land. They cultivated 100 times more land than they had done before using this technique. The results were failed crops. Crops died and rotted. And a huge number of humans, particularly little children, oddly enough, died of this. So when you misframe something, it really does make a difference. In that sense, the framing is an important way of us thinking. We need to really worry about how well we do it.
The way in which they position this book, it's quite confrontational, and it likes to challenge many of the things that we take for granted. What is the one thing when we get into a meeting and everybody is sort of thinking on the same sort of time frame, and they're thinking about things from the same perspective, and we say to them, no, think outside the box. And I wonder how, for example, when you start framing things and the way we think about things, these authors seem to suggest that thinking outside the box is actually a completely useless activity, which will surprise many.
I think that the issue is just thinking outside the box isn't usually it, because we're boxed in anyway. I think what the real issue is to try and get people, firstly, if you're sitting in a meeting, they say, think outside the box, don't bother. Because when you want to reframe something, it's not something that's quick, it's not something that comes easily. There's a technique and a thorough technique. You don't change from understanding the world in terms of the creation of the world, in terms of having a God and reframing it as having no God, just because you sat in the meeting and said, well, think outside the box, and you come up with a theory of evolution. There's a lot that goes into this. And I think the important part about framing, it's not just coming up with another idea. It's understanding that you're trying to tackle something which will take a lot of time and a lot of mental effort, and it's an attempt to look at things differently. One of the there are three factors in that they suggest when you want to frame something differently. One is called causality. Causality, we know human beings use causality all the time. What we know, for example, that if something's hot, it will burn your fingers, and we can say, well, that's what happens: hot burns fingers. Now, we can extrapolate on that causality and say, well, it doesn't have to be red hot. It can be white hot, or it can be anything in between, but it will still burn you. We might say, well, butter melts. So butter melts, okay? So what would happen if you try to melt zinc and you put it into a very hot pot? And so we use causality in places where we might not have thought about causality. That's the first one. The second thing he says is thinking in terms of counterfactuals. All a counterfactual really means is taking something which is not an obvious fact. And a quick example he gives is John wanted to become king. He went to get some arsenic. Now, those two things don't sound like anything. Nothing from those two sentences tells you, allows you to come up with any sort of connection or fill it in, unless you take something counterfactual. And the counterfactual is something that's not in the sentence itself. It's another way of looking at it. So you might say, well, John wanted to become king. And so what he did was he got himself some arsenic in order to assassinate the existing. That would be your counterfactual. And the third way of doing it, he says, is thinking in terms of constraint. The beauty of constraints is that when you're constrained by not having opportunities, you can actually come up with a better conclusion at the end. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure as a dad, you've read your kid Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham at some point. And in this book, the book is a worldwide bestseller. It has been for many years. It was written in 1916. Kids are still reading it now. What happened was Dr. Seuss, that wasn't his name, that's his writing name. He was his author, his publisher said to him, he bet him $50 that he couldn't write a book using only 50 words, and those 50 words could only be one syllable. And that was the bet, $50. And because they knew that if you share books, if you want children to read, they need to read books with a limited vocabulary, and they're easy to deal with. So 50 words and only one syllable each, and he comes up with Green Eggs and Ham. I think that this constraint causes people to come up with new frames.
I did not know that was the bet. 50 words of one syllable, Green Eggs and Ham, Sam I Am, all of that sort of stuff is as a result of a $50 bet. How to create success out of scarcity. That's brilliant.
Yes, it is. And I think that we're trying to reframe the world we live in. And you can do it by deliberately putting in place constraints. Where you can deliberately look for counterfactuals. What's missing here? What's not here? Because we look for all the obvious stuff. We're trying to find how we think about this with something that we haven't thought about before. And this requires some mental effort. But the nice part of the book is once you've bought into this idea that we can look at the world differently, it's not like thinking out the box, that's too simplistic. But if you can think in terms of look for counterfactual, think through it. It might take you days or weeks or months, but at least you're doing that. And that's when you can turn something from get out of a bind you're in. We want to come up with something new and original. It's generally not a flash of the obvious. It's usually a deliberate, and in his system, very deliberate way of looking at constraints, looking at counterfactuals, and looking at causality, and trying to play with those three things. And at the end of it, you can come up with something a whole lot better.
It's fabulous, isn't it? I mean, in a world where we are petrified of technology, actually, our ability to think is the thing that, so far at least, computers are yet to master, and that gives us the human advantage.
There's a book that I'm busy with at the moment, which helps with that. I'd love to pick that up with you next month, about what exactly computers can do and what they will be doing in the future. But you'll see that what comes up again and again in that book is the idea that in fact what they're talking about is this reframing, thinking in very, very different terms. And I think that when you're in an argument with anybody, the best thing you can do is to try and work out what's the frame that they're using.
I said, oh, no, it isn't. That's not the best way of But yes.
Yeah, there we go. There we go.
Your point is well made. And that way, with one final point, we come to the end of the discussion. Sorry, Ian, wrap up.
Yeah. It's the difference between looking at a man just taking the knee and saying to him how he's behaving so inappropriately when they're playing the American anthem, and somebody else is saying he's quietly and in a dignified way committing, protesting against something which she finds abominable. So it's, if we can try and think in terms of what's the person thinking, what are they framing? Why is it different to mine? And firstly, it's easier for two people to argue with each other and come to a conclusion. But even if you aren't looking about an argument, but you're trying to find a different way of understanding reality using these constraints, counterfactuals, and causality, be very, very interesting ways of doing it.
Thank you. Ian Mann from Gateways Business Consultants.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, Africa's largest agri-funder. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Other people's money.
On to Other People's Money this evening, and looking forward to chatting to a legend of TV production in South Africa. He's been doing it for... Well, let's not give too much away, I suppose, Clive Morris. Clive Morris is the chief executive and the founder of Clive Morris Productions. But you've been making programs, not only television, but corporate programs and documentaries and 50-50 for a long time.
30 years, hi, Bruce.
30 years? How did it start? What was your first gig? Were you a runner on a set of some description, or did you start? Did you start big?
I started very big. I played Wiffles, the watchdog.
No way, that was you.
I was the original Wiffles, Bruce, I have to admit it here. On...
I thought Adrian Galley had taken over that role of Wiffles. Wasn't he Wiffles at some stage as well? Was he your successor?
He took over from me. Yeah, he took over from me.
I don't know where that...
They still have my voice singing that opening number because it's been repeated for years. And I still, it's still my voice in that opening song. I never got paid a cent for it.
There's got to be a royalty payment there somewhere for you. There's got to be
somewhere.
And yeah, it just proves that Adrian Galley can't sing, because if they're still using your voice and he was your successor, oh dear. So we all started in some way or other, I suppose. You started in front of the camera. When did you move behind it?
Well, when we were doing the show, I started watching the directors and, you know, how they were doing it, and started writing episodes. And that's how I got into it. I thought, no, that's much more exciting. I didn't like being on the front of the camera, actually, though I'd studied drama. And so I started getting more and more involved in the writing. And I'd written a script, a comedy, a stage play, actually, called Made in South Africa, M-A-I-D in South Africa. And I came home one day, and my father said, "Oh, you must phone Creepy Crawley." I said, "Creepy Crawley? What does Creepy Crawley want with me?" "No, no, here's the number. I must phone Creepy Crawley." It turned out to be Penguin Films, not Creepy Crawley. And my dad had got them, because there were penguin pools in those days. So he'd got completely confused. And I never didn't phone, and it was Roberta Durrant at Penguin Films, who'd read my script and wanted me to write a comedy for her. And then I started writing and then got into production. She was my mentor.
Fantastic. I mean, one looks at your spread of work today, and I wonder if it is deliberately organic and simply mopping up every aspect of production that is available to you, or a survival mechanism to go from everything from broadcast to live events to documentaries to commercials and music videos to corporate clients to destination videos to virtual events to facilities to photography. Goodness gracious me. I don't think there's a box unticked here, is there?
I think it's a bit of both, you know, because you do in this country have to do a lot of things, I think in any industry, but I think specifically in ours, because, you know, I mean, a perfect example was COVID and all the live events just shut down.
Sure.
So there were no live events, and thank God we had broadcast and documentary. And now live events are back, so we're busy with that. So, you know, it's a bit of survival. But, you know, one thing leads to another and gets you into a different sphere. And then, you know, live, you know, directing live is just so exciting, the adrenaline rush. So I love doing that.
That's the big events. I mean, I don't know, but it's the sort of Miss South Africa scale stuff of live events where anything can and will go wrong, and you survive from your wits, from your experience, and leaning on the people next to you.
Absolutely. And you do rely on the people, and you've got to put big, really good people around you who've got the experience, because anything can go wrong and often does. I mean, we've had generators blow out 2 minutes before going on air and having to swap from a big generator to a tiny one and then hoping that it all comes back on just before a live show. So anything is possible. You do have to keep your wits about you.
What's been the biggest disaster you've overseen so far?
We did a production outside of the country, a big music production that I won't mention the name.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. They didn't have money for the generators. So the generators kept going out on us. They hadn't paid artists. And yeah, it was it was one of the productions I could have done without. But I suppose the experience of it gets you ready for whatever comes after that. So everything's a learning, and you've got to take the learning from it and not the hammering over the head.
Provided you survive it, of course. But I suppose once you get to scale, then you've got the capacity and you've got the reputation with which somebody can say, okay, that was a disaster, but let's move on. What's your favorite part of what you do now? You didn't like being Waffles in front of the camera, but you've got a whole array of activities, including some very popular soap operas, some very popular telenovelas, and other productions. What's your favorite aspect of what it is that you do?
I love writing, but I don't get enough time to write because, you know, running a company's full-time job. But I've got a wonderful business partner, and my wife is my
accountant.
Financial director.
Yes.
But between my partner, Dom Gumede, and Pam, I'm getting a bit more time to do some writing now. And I love directing too, but you know, you so seldom get time because you really got to focus on those things. You got to cut everything out and direct or write. And it's very hard to get time out to do that. And that's really what I love, but I've given other people the chance to do it instead of taking it for myself often.
How do you grow this business to a point? Pavlo Fatidis always tells us businesses either get to a point where they have to close down or they get sold. And this is such a diversified, substantial, it would seem, certainly from the outside, production company with, you know, you pay lots of wages, you pay lots of salaries, but the wages are sort of people who come in on project work, so you don't have to carry actors and teams of people there, I suppose. But how do you sort of eventually exit this business one day? Because surely you must want to do that eventually.
I wouldn't like to completely retire. I would love to keep, you know, working, especially if I can write and direct. But I think the way to do that is to keep young people around, which I do. I love young people. I love training young people. I love their ideas. They're so much better than mine, and they're so quick. And, you know, I love having young, energetic creatives around me. And, you know, they are what keeps the business growing and changing and developing. And you've got to listen to young people because they're so bloody bright.
And, is it lacquer? And that's the nature of the industry, isn't it? I mean, it's an industry that's deeply creative. It's an industry that is attuned with now and is kind of shaping, I suppose, our attitudes for the future because that's what popular culture does.
Yeah, for sure. And you've got to, the thing is that if you're going to bring people in, you've got to listen to them because there's no good having people around and not listening to them.
You've been reading Steve Jobs' biography, haven't you? That was Steve Jobs' philosophy. You've got to listen to the people you hire. Otherwise, why did you hire them in the first place? It's completely pointless exactly. Exercise. And if you're going to do it all yourself, well, then do it yourself. That's fine. But, yeah. You know, don't go hiring people for to get their ideas and then don't tap them for those ideas.
Yeah, for sure. You know, he's right. I must have told him that once.
I'm sure you did because he learned a lot from you. We're talking this evening to production specialist extraordinaire. I don't know what you are. He is Clive Morris. He is the chief executive, the founder and chief executive of Clive Morris Productions. We're talking business. We're talking about the way in which he's built Clive Morris Productions through multifaceted approach to anything that can be entertainment related, and including Feldfokus and 50-50, you can do it either way, and all sorts of other productions, massive live events as well, huge fashion weeks and all sorts of things, phenomenal track record of corporate videos and commercials and music videos, all of that sort of stuff. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of money and why it's important and how it matters with our guest this evening, Clive Morris at Clive Morris Productions.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, Africa's largest agri-funder. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
And tonight's guest is Clive Morris, who is the founder and chief executive of Clive Morris Productions. Have you ever raised funding? Have you done this bootstrapping, or have you taken on partners over time? How have you managed to grow to the extent that you have, Clive?
You know what? Raising funds in our industry is just so incredibly difficult. There was a Netflix symposium last week. And so many producers were discussing there that the banks just don't get us. They don't, after 30-odd years with the same bank, to try and explain what it is, production. You know, it's an industry that puts in billions into the GDP every year. And it could contribute so much more if people would just get it and realize you can actually make it work, especially now. You know, they say it's the golden age of TV. We've got all the streamers coming here. And that's really changed things for us. It really, really has changed things for us.
Somebody was saying in the early stages of COVID, anybody who's ever thought that, you know, the arts weren't important, now is surely the time to recognize the importance of the art, as people were sat on their couches at home watching Netflix and waiting for the pandemic to pass. And I think that lesson has probably been quite short-lived. So you've done this basically bootstrapping right from the very start. You've used your Wiffles money right at the very beginning as your seed funding then, I suppose.
Yeah, it was. Pam and I have put a lot back into the business. We, you know, that's how this industry works. You know, but things are changing in a sense. The broadcasters have historically always owned the IP, the intellectual property, in everything we do. It's commissioned, it belongs to them, they sell it, they make the money from it. And things are changing quite a bit now. We did something recently with an international broadcaster. And they were prepared to let us fund 30% of it, which was very difficult, especially during COVID when everything took much longer than it should have. So that was a very expensive 30%. But then we own that 30%, and it's now being sold. And so we're getting that back and plus. So things are definitely changing. The streamers that have come in have made a huge difference. They've opened it up for everybody, for all the producers.
And I suppose there must be a huge relief after the failures of the SABC, which must have been the biggest commissioner for a long time. Yes, Mnet has done a lot of good work, and there's been CakeNet and many other facilities. But the SABC for many, many years was the only place you could go to be commissioned. And then, of course, we all know the collapse of the SABC and the failure to pay and all of that sort of stuff over many years. That must have threatened you, I'm sure, from time to time in terms of your sustainability.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, the SABC has been a client of ours for 27 years, whatever it is. So you don't just turf out a good client because they're going through some tough times. So we've stuck with the SABC and they've really been good to us. It's been up and down. It's been very difficult at times. I think that's been in the public domain. It's not any secret. But, you know, you can't just turf people because they're going through a hard time. And the SABC is so important. I don't think we realize how many people still watch SABC who don't have access to the streamers and you know, ETV does fill in the gap there, but the SABC is still a very big player and should be. And, you know, it's a vital, vital institution. So I don't think we must just throw them out with the bathwater. And there are changes, and I think they're really trying hard to bring themselves back. But it's been a difficult road for the SABC and the producers.
I have no doubt. When you look at the shape that your finances are in after all of these years, pouring money in big ticket items, some projects would have worked better than others. You would have lost some money on some. You would have succeeded more in others than some. I wonder how confident you are about your financial future.
I think I would be less confident if it was not for the international streamers, broadcasters coming here. But I think they've opened up a whole new world for all of us. At the same time, they've fragmented the industry. So there's a lot of fragmentation and viewers that have been, taken away from our classic broadcasters. But still, they've opened up a whole new world for us. And it's been very exciting, just dealing with them and moving into that sort of domain where you can reach, an international market as well.
In South Africa, for many years, known as a great place to make adverts. But I just look at the huge developments around the Cape Town Film Studios, and I get a great sense of optimism in your industry that there is big money coming in, and it is becoming an increasingly sustainable industry after a couple of years of real hardship.
Absolutely. Oh, totally. It's definitely, they say it's the golden age, and I do believe it. I just wish I was 25 years younger, so that starting out now.
The groundwork, Clive. You've laid the groundwork for others. You'll be the shoulders upon which the giants will stand. You'll be the giant upon whose shoulders others will stand.
From your mouth to higher beings. But I think what you're saying, though, is that the youth is where the future is. And I think that is so. And I think, they just got it. They've got it. Great young filmmakers who just know what to do somehow. And of course, they're technically savvy, and they're marketing savvy. So I think the future is great for our television and film industry.
It's so nice to hear. It really is, Clive. Would you look, how many more years do you want to keep doing this at the rate at which you're doing it? So many people just can't let go. You said you don't want to retire, but surely at some point there's got to be, a coastal future or at least, sitting on the Northcliffe Ridge looking at the sunsets.
Yes, I think so. My wife tells me all the time that we need to retire, but my partner says not just yet. So we'll see. One day they'll check us out, I suppose. But as long as I can get a thrill out of it, I would like to keep doing it to some degree, perhaps not working as hard as I am. And I think a lot of my staff would be very happy if I would stop working as hard and just let go and let them do it.
Oh,
I'm getting told frequently that I need to just let go and trust people. So I am trying very hard to do that.
That's a blooming hardest thing. It is the curse, of course, of the founder that, you're there, you know how it works, you know where the not literally where the bodies are buried, but you know what I mean. And there are plenty. Clive, I think we'll start talking right now.
Plenty dead bodies in drama.
Clive Morris, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Clive Morris at Clive Morris Productions on Other People's Money, the founder and chief executive of an extraordinary South African enterprise you may not have clocked before.
Thank you, Bruce. Cheers.